thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 45 for the 13th of October, 2009. Wave hello, I'm Dan Cohen. And we've done it here at Digital Campus. We have actually stuck to the biweekly schedule that we advertise on our website at digitalcampus.tv, and we're glad to have you back. We're here, of course, with our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld and Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills. You're coming to us by phone today, as Tom did last time. How are you?
Yes, hello. I'm just fine.
Good. Good to have you on there. Mills, of course, available at edwired.org and fake Mills on Twitter at edwired, of course. Are you actually, have you adopted that edwired handle yet?
No.
Huh. Okay. Seems to interact with other people.
Yeah, somebody's doing it. I'm not sure who.
Okay.
They've never come forward. Whoever I am on Twitter has never identified themselves to me.
Okay. It's not me. You'll go down in the Hall of Fame as one of the great fake Twitterers.
You never know.
Yeah.
You and Shaq. Shaq, I think, has a fake.
Yeah. Who was there was someone good who had a fake. I can't remember who it was. Anyway, that's Tom Scheinfeld, of course, from foundhistory.org and at foundhistory.
Hello.
Hey, Tom. And you have a new Tumblr, right?
Yeah, I do. It's foundhistory.tumblr.com, and I'm really using it as a link post. It actually, this relates to my picks of the week, and I'll talk a little bit about it later. But basically, I realized I was putting a lot of kind of energy into Twitter. You know, things that I came across, describing links that I found on Twitter, and sending them out to people that way. And then I realized that, like, they just disappear after they kind of leave the stream. And so I was kind of investing a lot of energy and a lot of thought, I mean, as much thought as you can have in 140 characters, in Twitter, and I thought, like, I should be investing this back in the blog. So I started this Tumblr, which is basically just a place where I post links with short description of them, and then I aggregate those at the end of the day in a daily digest on the main blog, foundhistory.org. So I can talk.
It's really terrific. I mean, it's a great idea, and I'm sure it's a lot easier for you to just do those quick posts via the Tumblr, which it just makes it easier to share the content.
I would like everyone to note that Tom has already come at least partway back to my position about this.
Well, I have, but for different reasons. I still actually post everything to Twitter as well, and I enjoy the conversation that occurs on Twitter and the kind of the real stream of information, the real-time stream of information, and I'm still very much a Twitter partisan. I just, what I don't like about Twitter is I've realized that, you know, for 2.5 years, almost 3 years now, I've been putting value into this service that, you know, isn't paying me back. You know, the tweets from a couple of years ago have, for all intents and purposes, disappeared into the ether, and I can't really get those back. I have no record of those. If I wanted to use some of those thoughts in a longer blog post or in a journal article or whatever, it's not there for me anymore. So it's not so much that I'm annoyed by the stream of information. It's more that I want to feed that value that I'm feeding into Twitter. I want to feed it back into you know, something that could be useful for me someday.
I feel better and better.
Okay.
All right. Enough about me.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've had enough of you regulars discussing this stuff. We'd like to welcome to the podcast a new irregular, which we are very excited to have yet another person who's smarter than us join the podcast. It's Lisa Spiro. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Dan. I'm always happy to be irregular.
Thank you for joining us and joining the Digital Campus team. We're delighted to have you on. Lisa directs Rice University's Digital Media Center and also has a terrific blog, which everyone should subscribe to, digitalscholarship.wordpress.com. And also you created and run the really terrific wiki of digital research tools called DIRT. It's a great acronym, which you can find, I think, if you just Google DIRT wiki or Digital Research Tools Wiki, you will get that. And Lisa, you're just Lisa Spiro on Twitter, right?
That's right.
Well, it's terrific to have you on, and thank you for putting up with the three of us. I can't imagine why anyone would want to join us here. And I should also say that I'm currently being joined in a rather slightly annoying way, but hopefully helpful way, in creating the show notes for today's podcast on Google Wave, which I just got an invite to about an hour ago. And I now have Jeff McClurkin, Brian Croxall, Jason Jones, Ryan Cordell, and other people I'm adding as I can see them here. Let me see who else I can add. Kathleen Fitzpatrick has just joined us in the Wave room. Oh gosh, I'm sounding trendy, aren't I?
Yes. Yeah. You are, especially since none of the three of us have our Google Wave invitations yet.
We'll quickly cover Google Wave here. Of course, this, every year there's got to be some technology that all the digerati think is the future, and I guess this fall it seems to be this Wave thing. I have to say I'm staring at a screen now with lots of people typing at the same time, and in putting together show notes, and what I'll say is that they're adding notes in right now about their senses of Wave, and Jeff, who we had on the podcast last week, says it seems like it's less a replacement for email generally, but a nice replacement for email group discussions, and more of a combination of Google Docs and group chat IM. That's pretty much how it strikes me as well. Pretty much everyone can type at the same time, so you've got that real-time web that we discussed in our summer roundup that seems to be coming down the pike, where these real-time technologies are going to become more and more important. This is sort of Google's Uber version of this, I suppose, that we'll all have to take a look at. Hopefully for maybe Digital Campus number 46, all of us will have an invite and we can try it out there. But is this something that the three of you are interested in getting an invite to, and why?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of interested in getting an invite, just partly so I can be part of the cool crowd. Mostly, I would. Everybody's talking about it. I'd like to take a look at it. So far it sounds like Google Wave is a good place for talking about Google Wave. From what you were describing, Dan. I mean, I don't know if it will be. I have serious doubts, as I've expressed, on other shows, about whether, this is not. I can't imagine this is the future of email as they first build it. But it could be an interesting collaborative tool for certain uses. My guess is it will be good for a sort of small subset of things, and will be used for those, and it will sit alongside other tools like word processors and collaborative document editors and IM and Twitter and all the other email, all the other ways we have to communicate. I doubt it's the future of anything, but it probably is in some circumstances, a useful addition to the suite of tools we are already using.
Right. Could it be used as courseware? I mean, if we are already using wikis in some of our classes, this basically feels a lot to me as I watch the screen fill up with real-time text as a live wiki more than anything else, that you can also paste in YouTube videos and maps and little polls and things like that. Distance learning, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does have some real possibilities for distance learning, or for hybrid courses that are a little in the classroom, a little not in the classroom. Since I'm not using it, I can't say for sure. But I think that these kinds of collaborative spaces do offer some really interesting opportunities, and I think certainly a lot more interesting than the kinds of opportunities offered in the standard course management systems.
Right. Lisa, is this something you'd want to be involved in? Kathleen, by the way, Kathleen Fitzpatrick, writing live here on our little Google Wavelet about the podcast, says it's only starting to get interesting as a critical mass of folks on here whom I want to collaborate with join. was looking a bit like a party you threw to which no one came, which is exactly what I thought when I logged on this morning. Lisa, could you imagine uses for this? I mean, you've got a big, that Dirt Wiki that lists a lot of tools. Is it something where you also might list services like this that can be somehow shoehorned into the classroom or maybe into other research purposes?
I could see potential uses, and it's certainly a party that a lot of people want to go to if they could win a coveted invitation. But I think the idea of sort of real-time sharing of information is quite appealing and gets to this kind of larger trend towards the real-time web and interaction occurring very quickly. But to me, it's still pretty ephemeral. I think I need to know more about what it does before I can say whether it has the potential as a course management system.
Right. I do have to say it makes it very easy to put together, as I suppose WordPress does as well, just very easy to put together a page with multimedia elements and threaded discussion. And Brian Croxall, writing on this page, says the thing that matters is the ability to make waves public. And I think he's absolutely right that it seems like you not only want to collaborate, but able to publish these things to the web so that other people can view them. Because right now it's just seeming like a little sandbox that we're all playing in, and you can't kind of get it to other places. Brian saying that you have to be on Wave in order to play along, and that's a real problem right now. I think I'd probably agree with him then. Is this just a matter? I mean, if this had come out from a small company, would we be discussing it, or is this just because we have a Google obsession?
Probably the latter.
Okay. Well, speaking of our Google obsession, it is Digital Campus's bi-weekly discussion of Google Books. I suppose we have to mention this. So it looks like we're now a month away from a full ruling on this. The federal judge, Denny Chin, says that now the parties have until November 9th to revise this. Sergey Brin, this morning in the New York Times, we're recording this on Friday, the 9th of October, has a big editorial about Google Books. Brewster Kahle, the head of the Internet Archive, had a big post on this. It seems like it's all revolving now around, as a lot of the other secondary issues fall off, it's revolving around orphan books, isn't it? These books that are out of print and but still in copyright, and we can't find the authors, and there are quite a few of them. And isn't that the crux of the issue at this point?
It really is. And I was interested in Brewster Kahle's post of I guess a couple of days ago, where the proponents of the settlement have been saying all along that, like, we need to do this to get these orphan works into the hands of users. That Google has scanned these things; they need to have the settlement to make sure that these orphan works are available, and set up this book rights registry, which will make these orphan works available for use online. And that's been sort of the line throughout this, where we need to do this because we need to make these orphan works available. This is the only way to make these orphan works available under copyright law. And Brewster, I think, reminded us a couple days ago that it's not the only way. He quoted Eric Schmidt, Google's CEO, saying that opponents to the settlement should propose an alternative to solve the problem. And he said, well, there is an alternative, and the alternative is you change the law. For years, people have been working drive orphan works legislation through Congress. It actually passed the Senate last year. As soon as the settlement was announced, that the legislation basically died because people decided that this was going to be solved in another way. And it seems to me it's being solved in a way that's not really the way a copyright law should be solved. There should be a bill going through Congress. Congress should settle this issue. It shouldn't be settled by a private lawsuit and a private settlement in civil court. It just seems so. I was at that, actually, that post of Brewster's really changed things, at least my perspective on this, and just reminded me of what the real issue was and what the real solutions available to us are. I think we had all basically kind of, or many of us had gotten a little bit complacent and a little bit just worn out by all of this, and said, well, you know what? let the settlement go through, and you know, we'll have access to these books. But there is another way here, and I think that's important to remember.
Do you think that a settlement would stand in the way of pursuing a law on orphan works as well? I noted that in Bryn's editorial this morning, he said that Google supported legislation on orphan works as well.
Well, it seems to me like it's if this settlement goes through, it's going to, I mean, Congress is busy, lobbyists are busy. Google will have what it wants. So I can't imagine they're going to be putting their muscle behind it. They may support it in name, but I can't imagine that they're going to be up lobbying Congress, which other companies have been doing. And it sort of seems like a fait accompli where, you know, if the settlement occurs, then, you know, it'll feel good enough to people who have access to the corpus through their university or whatever. The people who are really concerned about this it'll feel good enough, and we'll have gotten what really is a second rate deal, but it'll be the deal that's in place. That's, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe there will still be legislation, but it seems like the legislation was moving through Congress, but it died when the settlement was first announced.
So, and the legislation would basically give a blanket license or some kind of copyright revision so that anyone could effectively make these orphan books available without major threat of copyright violation.
I think that's it, and I think if the copyright holders do turn up and claim their copyright, I think there'll be recourse for them. But I think for those that really are orphaned, for things that really are missing, you know, for copyright holders that really are missing, then those would be available for people to use.
Well, I'm going to truncate this right here because we seem to talk about Google Wave, Google Books. We'll try to move on from Google. Although, maybe just 1 minute on that, we didn't get to this last week. This Google Chrome and IE. Here at the Center for History and New Media, we do a lot of web development, and we often have to deal with the pain that is IE6 still, not to mention other versions of Internet Explorer. What does everyone make of this rather brazen attempt to effectively hijack Internet Explorer, Google's attempt to hijack Internet Explorer by basically inserting their own browser called Chrome within Internet Archive?
Within IE, yeah.
Not Internet Explorer, yes.
Well, for people who don't like developing for IE, this could be a great thing. I mean, I think Google has gotten so frustrated with Internet Explorer that they've done this so that they don't have to develop for it anymore. You know, on the flip side, there are concerns that this is a power play, and that this will serve to fragment the web, that, you know, people will develop sites for specific browsers, and they won't render correctly on other browsers, and you'll have a different web, different internets for people on different browsers.
Yeah, I ran into this problem with one of my grad seminars last week. I sent them back to a website developed, I don't know, 5-6 years ago with NEH funding on using GIS in the humanities, and nothing on that page nothing on that website will render on any version of any browser now. I mean, you'd probably have to go back and reload some old version of the browser to see it, and that's because the people who put it together, they built it only for Internet Explorer, and they built it 5 or 6 years ago, and it just doesn't work anymore. So to have more opportunities to work with different browsers, I think, is going to be great.
I mean, ideally, the browsers would all conform to Internet standards in a consistent way, but I think this reflects the fact that you have to make adjustments based on the variations.
Right. I mean, I guess the larger story is HTML5, which we mentioned, I think, on Digital Campus 43, that, you know, I think this is a good development, that there is a real standards-based, rich media, real-time web version of HTML that's coming. It's actually here on most browsers. It's not in IE. And that portends the end of a lot of annoyances, like Flash, which we've all hated, I think, because it's got a lot of problems in that. I mean, it's proprietary, it's inaccessible to people who are viewing web pages in other means, like audio browsers for people who are blind. And so we're getting rid of that, and we're getting rid of you know, or and we're adding the ability to do a lot of new kinds of live real-time things in the browser. It requires HTML5. And I think Google said, you know what, if the biggest browser is not going to implement HTML5, we're going to do it for them. We need it for Google Wave, but we need it for lots of other things as well. Okay, well, I guess we're sick of talking about Google. Let's move on. We can go back to the government and the Justice Department, which was weighing in on Google Books, is also weighing in on a couple of other issues, as well as the FTC and FCC. Well, I guess two big stories from there are the first is these new rules for bloggers. The Federal Trade Commission came out with guidelines governing endorsements and testimonials. And their guidelines now say that the post of a blogger who receives cash or in-kind payment, that's the key part here, to review a product is considered an endorsement. Thus, bloggers who make an endorsement must disclose the material connections they share with the seller of the product or service. And immediately after this came out, a publicist for Duke University Press wrote that the new rules, as she said it, quote, will have a chilling effect on the online book reviewing community. What did the three of you make of this? Is this really a worry for that university presses might have, or other presses that want academics to, you know, I receive books all the time in the mail. Do I need to disclose that? Should I disclose that?
Sure. I mean, it seems like there's just a common understanding when you're reading, reviewing a book or a record, that you received it gratis from the company. So I don't know that you need to be explicit necessarily.
I don't know. It sort of makes me wonder why this hasn't been the practice all along. I don't really see the harm in, you know, just putting a footnote or a line saying that, like, you know, I received this book gratis. It's not a huge burden on the reviewer. And I don't know if it should be encoded in federal law. I don't know if that needs to happen, but I also don't know why, this hasn't just been part of our, you know, ethical practice to begin with. It just seems like you got something for free. The reason you're reviewing it as opposed to some other book, maybe because it's sitting on your desk as opposed to some other book, which you may have to go to the bookstore to go get. And, you know, let the reader decide whether that makes, you know, whether that has made a difference in your review or not. I guess I don't understand why it would chill, why I wouldn't review a book because I had to say that I got it for free. But
don't you get the books for free when you review them anyway? I've never paid for a book that I had to review, so it's assumed that you've gotten the book for free.
Right. I mean, would this apply, for instance, to, let's say, the Journal of American History, that every review is going to have to say, I got the book for free?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see the argument about book reviews. I think it's possible that it's going to have some kind of an effect on how people write about websites. Or so, for instance, in the podcast, if we wanted to talk about some new pay service website or some product that, you know, charged money and that company had given us money, well, you know, proper ethics would require us to say, you know, we're talking about this and we're saying nice things about it, but we also should note that the center has received a $10,000 grant from this company.
Or what if a company gave us, you know, Dow Jones gave us access to free access for a month to one of their databases, and then we talked about it on the podcast. I mean, shouldn't we say that, you know, we got this access for free? This is a paid service, but we got it for free. I just don't see why, you know, greater transparency chills anything or is a problem for anybody. I don't know why the book publishers think that this is going to. I mean, I can understand why it might be annoying and why bother and isn't it assumed. I can see sort of like why, what's the point? But I don't see why it would create any kind of a chilling effect on the online book reviewing community.
I agree with that. I mean, I think the more transparent we are, you know, the more people trust the kinds of opinions that we're expressing. So there's not doubt about whether you're, you know, getting something out of putting forward this review. It's just a question of whether blogs are different than publications in journals or articles in newspapers, where you don't necessarily declare that the book was received for free.
I mean, isn't it kind of in some ways more problematic when, you know, if you were to link to the book using your Amazon affiliate ID or something like that, where you'd get direct monetary gain from, if you say, oh, this book is fantastic, and that link to the book on Amazon gets you 5% of the price of the book. That's something that I always teach my students about, to look for things like that as indicators of, you know, what a site's trying to do. And it's not always that obvious.
No, and I guess that's the question. Like, for bloggers who, you know, where, you know, my blog is free, I don't make any money on my blog, you know, it doesn't have ads, it doesn't have anything. I mean, I don't even know what is the FTC's jurisdiction over my blog anyway. You know, so there are those kinds of questions. But the general issue of, you know, should we, you know, does it hurt anybody to say, yeah, I got this book for free? I just don't think it does.
You know, just in this vein, I feel like we should rename this podcast Digital Government here. This does seem like the fall where there are some pretty big government rulings that might affect what goes on campus and at museums and libraries. Just one final story on that front before we get to some other news. The FCC seems really likely to push this net neutrality forward. That also seems to, that could have a big impact, couldn't it? I mean, this is a policy that would say that no traffic on the net can be privileged over any other piece of traffic by internet service providers like AT&T or Verizon. Will that have an impact? I mean, we discussed this way back. I've been looking through our show notes while we're talking here about things like Skype on campus, where absolutely, I mean, most campus IT units do what's called packet shaping, and they compress and you know, reduce the amount of Skype traffic, or worse, you know, file trading to kind of maintain the network and the operations of the network. Is this something that will have some kind of broad impact on the cultural heritage world and on campuses?
I just don't think that there's a whole lot in the story for higher education. I mean, I think that we're already pretty net neutral on campus, and I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact on us. I think it's more about the commercial world.
Okay, fair enough. Maybe this is a story we'll come back to as we see precisely how it develops. Doesn't seem to have that direct impact that this FTC ruling has right now, where there are very, very specific guidelines. So maybe we'll put this in the stories that are developing. Oh, I'll put it on Google Wave.
There you go.
And we'll update it there. Look on Google Wave for updates on that story. Well, let's go over to another story. I guess we've obsessed about the Kindles, but maybe this is a follow-up, I suppose. We did talk to Stan Katz of Princeton University in the spring, and Stan was one of the first professors who was going to use the big form factor Kindle, the Kindle DX, in his class. And now we have a story from the Daily Princetonian, the student newspaper there. Mills, you've been following this. So what did Stan find out about using these things, and how do the students react to using these devices in class?
Well, I haven't talked to Stan personally, and I was actually going to go up and visit his class, but unfortunately it's the same day as my grad seminar, so I can't make it up this semester, but because I really wanted to see for myself how they were doing it. But at least based on this story in the Princeton student newspaper, I'd say the results are really mixed. The students say it's really convenient to be able to carry around all their readings on one device, and so certainly their backpacks weigh a lot less. And some of the students are saying that, well, you know, it is easier to read on. Others are saying, no, it's actually harder to read on. What Stan says in the interview with the student newspaper is that he's finding it a little difficult to make the transition from the analog course that he's taught before to this Kindle-based course, largely because the books that he uses and the resources that he uses, he's got all marked up already, and if he was going to then, you know, use the Kindle version, he would have to go into the Kindle version and mark it all up again. And so that's, you know, that's, I think, going to be an issue as people try to make the transition to whatever kind of device it is, whether it's a Kindle or something else, that, you know, things that are born in that digital realm will be fine. Things, of course, that you've been teaching for quite a while, it may be a lot more difficult. And so I'd say that this is the if I could summarize the story in the Princeton paper, it's really just the results are very mixed. Nobody's said, oh, this is the greatest thing ever or the worst thing ever. The headline, I think, says it all. Kindle's yet to woo university users.
Right. I've been looking into ebooks as part of a project I'm working on, investigating whether a new university library could rely primarily on digital content. And the big sticking point is monographs, partly because of problems with devices in terms of their usability for research. It's hard to annotate ebooks, whether you're using the Kindle or the Sony e-reader. I think the cost is still an issue. People aren't really excited about shelling out $300 for another device. I think there are issues in terms of citing from electronic books because you're only citing a location number rather than a particular page number. I mean, of course, there are advantages, too, in the ability to have access to so much of your reading material, to have the ability to look up the definition of words and so forth. But I think there are some issues that still need to be sorted out before we see these being widely adopted, despite the increasing, purchasing of Kindles and other ebook devices.
Do you think these devices are actually good reading devices? I mean, I actually haven't really sat down and spent a lot of time actually reading on them. Is this something that, students also tend to skim. I'm not sure how good they are at that either, given the delay in that e-ink technology of flipping the pages. Or even just getting, to a specific part of it.
I use the Kindle on my iPhone, the Kindle app on my iPhone, and it's great as a late night insomnia reading device because, I can just be in bed and read without disturbing my husband. I find it perfectly pleasant to read on it. It's just when it comes to taking notes, that's not at all supported right now on the iPhone app. And when I experimented with the Kindle 2, it was just kind of clunky to annotate the books there.
I just wouldn't be surprised if this is the kind of thing that isn't adopted on a classroom by classroom basis, but more on a student by student basis. That certain students will want to use the Kindle and will want to get their books that way, and then others will want a hard copy, and it will be more of an individual choice rather than a kind of programmatic or pedagogical choice where the instructor is saying, okay, everyone get a Kindle in the way that Stan is doing. I think it's probably we're going to gradually see students turning up, a student here, a student there, a student there, with Kindles in our classrooms and with using Kindle as opposed to hard copy texts.
So where's the demand going to come from? You think the demand then will come from students who are saying, hey, this is my preferred device. I want my textbooks on it. I want my assignments on it. Or is it going to be, as the Princeton experiment seems to be, that the professor or the administration says, okay, well, we're going to put this in the classroom. Everyone's going to get one of these.
Yeah. Well, I think the demand, I think we're at a kind of inflection point here where we're getting to an inflection point where, the price, as the price comes down, which we saw that it just did, came down by another $40 this week to $259. As the price comes down, as the price of the books gets a little bit lower, which right now I don't believe the academic books, the textbooks are that much cheaper on the Kindle. As the pricing kind of falls down a little bit, I think you're going to get an incoming freshman who says, okay, I can get this $200, let's say the price is $199, I can get this $200 device, and then all of my textbooks for the rest of my 4 years here are going to be 30% cheaper. This will be a cost-cutting measure over time, and then I'll be able to have, and then all the other advantages, I can carry them around with me. It also does other things. I can read the newspaper, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's probably, I think right now it's still too expensive for your average student user. But as it gets, down closer to the price of an iPod, I imagine we're going to start seeing, certain students, maybe the more tech savvy and you know, interested in technology, those students, I think we're going to start seeing more and more of them choosing to use it. But I'm not sure it's going to be a something that really works as, you know, a classroom by classroom kind of thing.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it did come down $40 this past week to $259, but Sony's, the Pocket Edition e-reader is already under $200. And it seems like you said, I mean, it's got to get in that iPod area, $99, $150 for the kinds of iPods that students generally buy versus these high-end devices. Okay, well, I think we'll have to leave it there, but certainly something that we have been following on the podcast and also on this increasingly cluttered Google Wave I'm looking at here. Just a note at home, don't try to use Google Wave when you're doing anything else, especially operating heavy machinery.
But I also think we should get, at the end of the semester, we should try to get Stan in and tell us how it went.
Yes, well, let's definitely have Stan back on the podcast and ask him what he thought of it from a professorial side. That would be really interesting to get his perspective. Time for our picks of the podcast, things that we found interesting that we think our audience might find interesting. Mills, what do you have for us this time?
Well, mine is an article that's in the most recent edition of First Monday, which we've an online journal we've talked about a number of times on the podcast. And this one is one I have to say I'm really happy about. It's called Everyday Life Online, U.S. College Students' Use of the Internet. And what I like about it is that it's it's a study, it's a real survey of students at 40 different colleges and universities. And so it's actual data about how students are using the Internet as opposed to all the conventional wisdom that we all love to throw around. And so this one, I think, is really kind of required reading. So I highly recommend it.
Okay, great. Tom, what do you have for us this time?
I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that I'm now, I've got this Tumble log, I've got my main blog, and I've got my Twitter stream. And I've got a couple of tools to suggest to kind of connect some of those up so that you can, you know, post things to different places and you'll have kind of coverage across all of your outlets. The first thing is called Twitter Feed, and it's at twitterfeed.com. And basically all that does is you can give Twitter Feed an RSS feed and tell it how frequently you'd like it to check that feed. And whenever it detects something new in the RSS feed, it publishes it with a standard head note of your choice to Twitter. So whenever I publish something to my Tumble log, Twitter feed picks that up and then just spits out a post to Twitter saying with the title of the Tumble log post, so that my Twitter followers can hear about it. So this is the way that I've used the Tumble log to kind of replace Twitter, that I've been able to still post links to Twitter, but while keeping a sort of more permanent record of it. On my own blog. The second thing is called RSS Digest, and it's a WordPress plugin. And basically what that does is, and it's very easy to use, very configurable, and what it does is it, at the end of the day, at a time of your choosing, it goes to another service, either your Twitter stream or your Tumble log or some other feed. It picks up that feed and it takes all of the posts to that feed for the previous 24 hours and puts them into a digest post. So this I use. I post things to my Tumble log, and then at the end of the day, RSS Digest picks up all of those posts for the day and publishes it as a briefly noted post to my main blog. So these are two tools.
That's really nice automation. Yeah.
Yeah, there's two tools to kind of connect all your different streams online, and they're both really easy to use and worth checking out.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And again, we'll post links to all of these resources at digitalcampus.tv. Lisa, what do you have for us?
So I have the Horizon Report Wiki. Every year, the New Media Consortium and EDUCAUSE together release a report focused on emerging technologies for teaching, learning, and creative expression. And right now, the advisory board is engaged in the kind of information gathering activities and beginning to vote on the emerging technologies that will sort of make the cut for the report. But you can see sort of how the sausage is made by looking at the wiki. And it's a real treasure trove, I think, of information about various technologies that seem to have promise for education, as well as trends in higher ed. And you can watch the discussions about these different technologies and trends unfold. It brings transparency, I think, to the process of putting together a report like this.
Yeah, so I'm joining in that this year, and I've seen your post. It is really great, and it's a great place to pick up a sense of what's to come, even though a lot of this stuff won't end up in the report. Actually, in some ways, the wiki's better, isn't it?
That's my sense as well. I mean, I've followed a lot of the links that people have thrown into the wiki and been really impressed by just how much good stuff is there. I mean, you do have to wade through a lot, but I think it's worth the effort.
Yeah, I agree completely. Great, and we'll post that link as well. Well, I've given a lot of serious links on the podcast recently, so I thought I'd do one that I've found fairly humorous, and it's a blog called Futility Closet, and it's great for people who are interested in bizarre stories from history. Tom, this is where I found the octopus wrestling story. yesterday we were discussing one of the stories of the history of octopus wrestling, which I did find on Futility Closet. I actually saw a link to this blog from another serious blog, academic blog that I follow. And it's just at futilitycloset.com. And a guy named Greg Ross curates it. You can submit interesting tidbits. And as I mean, they've got things from a variety of the humanities literature. They've got great quotes, sort of funny quotes. But a lot of it is history. And in fact, today, there's a post on strange things that happened in Buckingham Palace from 1838 to 1841. Just something to check out on your lunch hour if you want to subscribe to what Greg calls an idler's miscellany of compendious amusements. And it's certainly that Futility Closet, the blog. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We're looking forward to having you back on. But we hope everyone follows us at on Twitter at Digital Campus. Interestingly, while we're podcasting, I don't know, maybe it was Google Wave, but we had six people join us on Twitter. Follow us on Twitter during the podcast today after we tweeted that we were recording. And maybe we'll get a link to that public Digital Campus number 45 discussion that we had going on live. So other people who join Wave in the next couple of weeks can look at that and the conversation that went on with a bunch of us about what's good and bad about Google Wave. Until then, in 2 weeks, hope you enjoyed the time, and we'll talk to you again in another 2 weeks on Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do.